When you're driving through the suburbs of Kansas City, you see countless office parks, and you can tell that's what they are, even if you have no idea who works there and what they're doing. Clusters of identical mirrored buildings reflect the sky. They're gathered around a parking lot, surrounded by lush green grass, and usually there's some kind of pond or waterfall. They're so commonplace, we barely notice them, but they're a huge part of our suburban cityscape, if that's not a contradiction in terms, and someone put them here on purpose. So who did this and why? I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today we're getting into the past, present, and future of office architecture, starting with those reflective structures in the suburbs. Let's start with Doug Stockman. He's with us from Helix Architecture in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Doug.
Good morning, Gina.
You've spent most of your career focused on the urban office spaces that have become fashionable again, and we'll be hearing about that later. For now, tell us about the history of the suburban office park.
Well, I think you could, if you really want to put it into its greatest historical context, I think you could really go back to the founding fathers and Thomas Jefferson, who wanted to push the United States into the Western frontier and really start to sort of expand upon the agrarian culture of what he envisioned the country moving towards.
I am very surprised we're taking this back to Thomas Jefferson.
Well, there was a moment in time during his tenure of our country in which he had a certain distrust of cities and also an aspiration to conquer, but to really develop and pioneer the Western frontier. And he wanted to do so through the promotion of land and getting pioneers to move out and actually cultivate the vast amounts of land that we had. So I think that sort of set a tone many, many years ago.
Yeah.
And if you leapfrog forward to post-war, World War II, the suburbanization of America, predominantly initially with houses and this desire for people to find more open space, bigger homes, a little more space in between those homes, a different type of lifestyle, a different choice for people to live. And I believe it was then that the idea of bringing the workplace closer to where people lived, at least those people who chose to live outside of the city, there was a genuine intent to create a better environment through the design of office parks a few years after that initial suburbanization of America. And the result being what we have, or what we see a lot of today, that are sprawled around our urban cities.
So you see this as being tied to an agrarian ideal? That's really interesting to me. Can you explain that?
Well, I think throughout history, Americans have decidedly made different kinds of choices than our ancestry. Most of our ancestry came from Europe in densely populated cities. So be it for freedom of religion or a different choice in an urban environment that people chose to live in, I think there's always been sort of this desire to live in open space. And you see that throughout small towns across America. And for those people who remained in cities and still worked in cities, suburban life became a sort of halfway in between. I can't go be a farmer, but because my job is here, and so this is a nice happy medium.
How does the architecture of the kind of office park I described reflect that?
Well, I think that's the struggle that many architects today, sort of looking back upon what we as a profession alongside our clients created during the 70s and 80s and a good portion of the 90s, quite honestly. It's hard to find a lot of redeeming qualities in my mind about the architectural significance of those places, because they were really driven to be hyper-efficient office space extremely flexible and almost in a way intentionally devoid of specific character, because they were intended to serve many tenants, not just one user, but maybe 10, 15, 20, 50 users.
So wait, you see there as being very little redeeming quality in these spaces.
From an architectural standpoint.
Right. I mean, why? Can you say a little bit more about that? Like, what about them?
I think this is a personal perspective. There may be quite a few people who disagree with my thinking, but maybe this is because of my upbringing. I grew up in these environments. And
where?
Specifically Northern Virginia, just outside of D.C. So this might be arguably the birthplace of suburban office parks. Washington, D.C. was a very robust city, always has been, and the idea to create these kind of places was commonplace. And even as a young aspiring architect, moving from a high school diploma into thinking about where I wanted to go to architecture school, I had a few internships, and during those internships, we plowed through one iteration after another of suburban office park design. And so they became, they really lacked any kind of thought beyond.
It was like a template.
It was a template.
What was included in the template? What are the crucial characteristics?
Parking. An elevator and stair core. And how sculptural can you make the building, essentially?
What do you mean?
Well, they began with simple boxes. Clad in steel, concrete, and glass. And then that was obviously, as architects do, there's a desire to be innovative in some capacity or another. And so those sort of initial ideas then evolved into, well, how sculptural can we make it? Can we put in a curve? You know, these kind of basic, simple moves that really didn't really involve a lot of infusion of a soul into the building, where I think you'll find in any urban center is there's this kind of character that exists there, and there's a reason why. So,
you know, people once, I mean, during the same time period we're talking about, really wrote off the urban architecture for whatever reason, it might not have been architectural, but wrote off these spaces as places that were undesirable for one reason or another. Do you think that there's a possibility that someday we will be able to be far enough from these, these structures that were popular maybe in our childhoods and our early adulthoods to say, oh, there was something about this that we just haven't been able to see?
Good question. What I will say is that we are now reaching a point where we actually have an opportunity to go back and look at these office parks as they were originally designed and try to understand what is currently happening in today's workplace environment. And you can read this pretty consistently across the country. There's a gravitational pull towards urban centers. And that's primarily because the workforce that is out there right now, and they desire something very different from what workforce desired back when these office parks were created. So they're grappling with a new challenge of how to reinvent the suburban office park. And I think it's a tremendous opportunity to dig into that question and understand first and foremost why people are moving to the city, what attracts young people to not just working but living and playing in the city.
And when we say people, we're speaking very specifically about white-collar professionals, because that's who works in offices.
Predominantly, yes. And they're desiring an environment that's walkable. They want to be able to walk out the door at lunchtime and go to either a restaurant or a coffee shop or go to a physical fitness center or something else, a place of respite, a small pocket park or something like that. but that it's a choice and it's an option. There's options available to them. And the challenge with suburban office parks is they're very singular in their use. But you're starting to see those places evolve and understand what's attractive about cities and trying to bring some of that fabric and infuse that kind of community through a variety of uses to create a more vibrant place to work beyond what it is today.
So can you talk a little bit more about what you think maybe people did want at the time that these these office parks were created? What need was that serving other than close to where I live? Because it seems like, I don't know, maybe this is a weird thing to say, but when I was a teenager in the 90s, these places were really kind of the picture of professionalism. I remember visiting my mom at a place like that after watching her work to establish her career and feeling really like she'd made it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, she was in a beige place.
They became prominent. I think initially they were out of a desire for convenience. I mean, you got to remember people were driving from the suburbs, sometimes depending on where you lived, 1 to 2 hours into work, into the city. So shortening that commute and improving the quality of life. And I think that's really where it was. It was about the quality of life for them. And then it became a status symbol. All of a sudden, the suburban office park became the place that you wanted to work.
Does the changing popularity, the decline maybe of a place where, I don't know, it's surrounded by grass and there's a big parking lot and you show up and you take your elevator that's next to a stair corridor to a place with a water cooler, like that model maybe losing some of its cachet and the rehabbed urban space becoming more popular with maybe like a bright orange wall somewhere. Does that say something about a changing way we think about work?
I think so. I had an opportunity a couple years back to work with a company in the suburbs who desired the kind of space that you would find, say, in the Crossroads community, warehouse, raw, open, tall ceilings. But they didn't want to move downtown. They wanted to remain in a suburban location. And so our task was to design a new building that achieved that same kind of quality of environment that they desired out of the buildings that existed downtown. So I think people are paying more attention to their work environment, that it's not about your office around the perimeter of the building. Everyone gets their own private office, carpeted floors, acoustical tile ceilings. I think people have moved beyond that. They realize that it takes some of the sort of the vibrancy of the workplace when you isolate everyone from everyone.
Well, we're heading to a short break, but you can join our conversation at 816-235-2888. Tell us about your office building. Is it a nice place to spend the day? Is it set up to help you get stuff done? Does it make you feel proud of where you work and what you do? Does it have vibrancy? I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be taking those calls after the break. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I've been talking with Doug Stockman of Helix Architecture about office architecture. We've been zooming in on suburban office parks with reflective surfaces and prominent water features. You know the ones we're talking about. And we want to know where you work and how it makes you feel. 816-235-2888. We're interested in, knowing how the built environment of where you work is part of your life. Daniel Serta is with us from Insight Planning. He's our go-to guy for all of our big questions about the built environment. Daniel, what do you think of as the story of suburban office parks?
Well, I think it does start in the way that Doug described, with the sort of Jeffersonian agrarian ideal and the escape from the city. I would add to that a couple of fairly specific ideas, one of which is American suburban environments really grew up, so to speak, in terms of a major transformation of where people lived after World War II. And there were really two things that fundamentally shaped the character of those environments. One was the fact that we had the primacy of the automobile and the idea of commuting long distances for relatively long amounts of time, Doug mentioned an hour or two in some cases, became much more the norm. That meant that locating these facilities became a question of access and ease, and the presumption was everybody is getting there via automobile, which means in terms of functional requirements, parking becomes a dominant issue for these types of spaces. The other thing I would add in as a good planner is zoning. And, you know, zoning is a system that was devised primarily to separate the places that we work from the places that we live. And zoning did that in a couple of ways. In a suburban environment, it did especially by specifically designating certain areas for purely commercial use and other areas for purely residential use, especially near the highways, near the major arteries of the suburban environment. But it also did it by specifying requirements like how much parking proportionally has to be assigned to facilities like this. It's a very functional, very programmatically driven kind of way of looking at things. So I would see those as sort of the large forces that shaped the character of those environments that had really fundamental impacts. And then one other thing I would add, I think Doug mentioned his work years ago in designing some of these environments. I had some exposure to that both in terms of places I worked and in terms of thinking about it a little bit from a real estate development perspective. And one of the things that struck me back then, this is the late 80s, early 90s, is that the program of these kinds of facilities was primarily driven, when you really got into conversation with developers about them, by what do you need in the way of fitting out the interior space of your office. It was not driven by, you know, what do you think about the surrounding context and environment where you work? That was just sort of a background issue. And because of that, you end up with a lot of attention on the inside and not so much attention to the outside, which is part of what contributes to the mirrored beige boxes that you referenced.
The mirrored thing is so strange, though. I mean, you drive by and you kind of see like the clouds or, you know, there'll be like a peach colored concrete or something sometimes with like a bluish tinted glass that reflects clouds. Sure. It seems in some way like an attempt at something, and I don't know what that is.
Well, you're describing it as a visual, the visual character of the exterior to you, but you have to think about it from the user's perspective. The primacy of all-lit glass was about giving everyone a view. And a view of what? A view of a lot of greenery, a lot of open space, the exact kind of agrarian ideal environment that Doug was describing. It's almost incidental that it ends up being sort of mirrored. It was mirrored because the reality of building a building with that much glass is that it gets really hot when you have that much sunlight coming into the space. And so you have tinted windows to kind of, you know, cut down on the amount of heat energy that's transferred into those spaces. And that creates a certain aesthetic effect on the exterior. But that's secondary to the idea of giving everyone a view.
So, but if this whole thing goes back to Thomas Jefferson, how do you explain the fact that before the 1970s or whatever, that like the really prominent office buildings that were created in cities, and that at one point those became the defining structures of cityscapes throughout America?
Well, that went back well before the 1970s. I mean, the real peak period of skyscrapers and the sort of creation of the major skylines of cities as we know them, including Kansas City, is back in the 1920s. In the run-up to the Depression. But part of what happened was you had people not only wanting to live outside the city and a lot of concern about, you know, disorder and crime and all, you know, congestion, excess congestion in where people lived, but there was also, you can find that exact same kind of narrative describing the places that people worked. It's ironic, you know, the marketing shtick, so to speak, back in the 60s and 70s about these places was it's not difficult to park, unlike trying to drive into a downtown where you can't find any place to park. And if you do, you have to pay for it. You know, whereas out here, parking is free and abundant and available everywhere. There was a certain degree of aversion to the sort of controlled chaos of the city that's absolutely a factor of it. And that, again, that's why I think Doug's absolutely on point, because Jefferson, part of the notion of the agrarian ideal all comes back to a fundamental distrust of the congestion and the dense concentration of people and activities in cities. Jefferson was not an urban thinker at all. He was very much thinking about the antidote to what he perceived as the ills of urban society. And again, we've gone through waves of that. We're at a different place now in our history, thankfully, relative to cities. But there was a lot of aversion to the congestion of the dense office environment of downtowns. I had direct exposure to that. I was working in a real estate firm when I was in college in a building at 11th and Grand. And most of the agents there were leasing space out in West Lenexa and Southern Overland Park. And it was interesting hearing the contrast. I mean, I even heard a couple of those agents grumbling about the space that we had the office in because it was so difficult to get into and out of. And the building was old and the space was more congested. And the architecture of the 1920s was not conducive to these sort of open, congenial environments where people could sort of see everyone and be in a more flexible working environment. They were seen as a lot of constraints. So there were a lot of those things that dovetailed back on themselves. And I find it interesting now we're at a place, as Doug described, where the congestion, the interest, the variety, the experience of being in a city is driving not only people to come back into the city, but it's also starting to change how those suburban office environments are thought about.
When you hear Daniel's description of the building he used to work in at 11th and Grand, where people would grumble about all the constraints of the 1920s architecture, are those the kind of features that you often work with now in the work you do to rehab spaces or create new urban environments?
Sure. And I wasn't there with Daniel, so I can't speak to exactly the environment he was in. But, here's what I'll say. There's good design and there's bad design everywhere. And it might have been that the office space that he was in downtown at that time was just simply not well designed. And I think with any building that you hope to rebirth in some way, you have to do it in the context of how we work today or how we play today or how we live today. And so while it's extremely exciting to work within the urban context right now of rejuvenating all of our old buildings, and there's just as much opportunity in these suburban office parks to start to think about how you can re-envision their place in today's society.
Tell me, what are some thoughts about that?
Well, Daniel said something about sort of the ills of society, right? And Jefferson's take on it was from that vantage point at that particular time. And I think where we are today is that there's the level of consciousness of what our footprint is on the global environment has been raised to a peak level. I would say that most people are now painfully aware of what we do to contribute to that. In architecture, the buildings and homes, the places in which we reside and that we wish to make comfortable through heating and cooling consume close to, I think the latest percentage is 42 to 43% of all energy created in this world. And so therefore, our buildings and us as planners and architects should be good stewards in making our buildings more sustainable. And the opportunity in suburbia, I think, is in these office parks, is that thought was not even a consideration. And so one opportunity beyond giving these places a new life is doing it in such a way where they're more environmentally friendly.
And so I guess that what I'm really curious about is when I think about the kind of challenge you take on now, looking at something that was built a long time ago, then fell out of favor, and now people want to re-inhabit those spaces in the city, but working in very different ways from the way they worked when those places were built and living in very different ways from how we live when those places are built, having a very particular kind of taste that's distinctly early 21st century. Does it excite you or maybe bother you to imagine someday someone looking at suburban office parks in a similar kind of way? And what do you imagine the questions are that they will be asking, what the problems are that they'll be solving?
Well, I think it actually might begin at a planning level. And that is, it is... In one respect, it's exciting to think about them being reinvented and maybe rethought in a more compelling fashion. And I think it begins with planning. It's about diversifying the zoning for the area to allow for a more vibrant community of activities.
So step out the door and there's a variety of stuff going on rather than step out the door, get in your car, and go find something somewhere else.
Exactly. And, you know, zoning is very monolithic in that respect. I mean, we've certainly come a long way in the last 10, 15 years in terms of creating the more flexible, adaptable model that Doug is alluding to. But back in the 70s and 80s, if you were building a commercial office park, you had sort of a commercial office park zoning attached to the entire site. And the sites could be, you know, acres and acres and acres. And what that meant was the only primary use that was allowed there was an office. In other words, you can't have a restaurant right next door. You can't have a, and even further than that, within the building itself, you technically are not allowed to have that other mixture of uses. I find it really intriguing that it's not, it's certainly novel. It's a new approach in a suburban context, but we don't flinch at the idea that somebody might be looking at an older, say, 4 to 6 story suburban office building and talking about readapting part of it where 2 stories become housing. That would have been anathema back in the 70s and 80s. Well, what? Who's going to live there? Who would possibly want to live? And I mean, that's not the purpose of that. The purpose of that is to serve as an office. So the regulatory piece is real. It's especially real relative to the functional requirements like the parking. That's something where there's actually a significant degree of pushback, whether it's from people in the industry, a certain degree at a policy level. There's always a lot of concern about managing the traffic associated impact of especially of commercial development. But again, even there, we're starting to finally rethink some of that. And part of that starts with the reaction and the recognition that there wasn't necessarily a lot of science behind those requirements. It was just assumed, you know, you need an abundant amount of parking. And one of the things you see, and it becomes very much an environmental concern, as Doug was alluding to, is even at peak periods, you know, a lot of suburban environments, you see a lot of that impervious surface empty. And so there are a whole range of concerns that have to be managed. But I think it's really interesting because there are some really significant developments where either buildings are being repurposed. In some cases, the sites are being scraped clean. And we're starting over in suburban environments with some of those buildings. And what's being pursued now, and you can see examples of this throughout the region, probably the one of the tangible examples a lot of people are familiar with is the Park Place development in Leawood. That is as mixed use as you would find almost in a true urban environment, in a purely suburban environment off one of those major arterials, you know, the College Boulevard corridor, where everything 40 years ago would have been exclusively office next to those major roadways, you know, set back some degree from residential environments. There's living there, there's shopping, there's entertainment, there's the sort of employee amenities like health and wellness that Doug alluded to. And there are major companies that are deciding to make that kind of environment their location.
Daniel Serta, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
Doug Stockman, this has been great.
Thank you.
Daniel's with us from Insight Planning, and Doug came in this morning from Helix Architecture. Up next on KCUR's Central Standard, the story of a guy from Kansas who founded environmental psychology from a field lab called Midwest. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now let's take a little trip back to the middle of the 20th century, when everything psychologists knew about human behavior came from tests conducted in labs. A guy from Kansas by the name of Roger Barker changed that. He was considered the founder of environmental psychology, which posits that people's surroundings affect their behavior. Here to tell Roger's story is Ariel Sabar. He's the author of a biography called The Outsider, The Life and Times of Roger Barker. Hi, Ariel.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, thank you.
So this guy is really significant in how the history of psychology unfolded. Can you explain Roger Barker's significance?
Yeah, I mean, what made Roger Barker this kind of renegade, kind of maverick psychologist is that, as you said in the introduction, up until about the 1940s, the primary way in which psychologists went about trying to understand how humans behave was to basically set them down in the lab and give them intelligence tests, ask them to solve finger mazes, measure their reaction times. You know, there were sort of these rigged up experiments that didn't really tell you a whole lot about how humans behaved in the real world, which is where most of us live. Most of us don't live in a laboratory.
And so, as fun as that may be.
As fun as that might be for a select group of people. And, you know, so what he wanted to do is, as he put it, he had this very colorful way of phrasing it, is that he wanted to study the, quote, naturally occurring behavior of free-ranging persons. And so the question Roger Barker had asked himself was, where can I do that?
And what answer did he come up with?
Well, the answer he came up with was that, you know, after being hired to chair the psychology department at the University of Kansas in 1947, he very quickly told, you know, one of the deans that this is great, love being here in Lawrence, but what I need is a town. I need a town of about, you know, 800 people, not too far from here, that's surrounded by farm fields, so it's kind of self-contained, but that's kind of representative of kind of the iconic American small town. Is there, what do you have for me? And so the dean basically said, I've got just the place. It's a town called Oskaloosa, Kansas, and it's about 20 minutes from here, but it's really in a sort of different world. Probably very, very few people who live in Lawrence or who attend the university even know about it, even though it's a short drive away. And so Roger Barker decides to do not just to sort of study Oskaloosa, but to move there for good and to take his three young children. You know, he had three young children at the time. He was married. He packed up his family, moved to a like ramshackle house in Oskaloosa, Kansas, enrolled his kids in the public schools, joins the Rotary Club, joins the churches, sends his kids to the 4-H clubs. And,
so he's a totally objective observer.
Well, that's what his hope is. He hopes to go into this town and be, you know, this kind of this eye that is watching everything that's happening in the town. And he actually sets up his central office in an old kind of abandoned bank building on the town square. And he calls that office the Midwest Psychological Field Station.
That sounds like a science fiction kind of like bunker or something.
Yeah, I mean, it has that, I guess it sort of has that resonance. And in fact, I think the irony, of course, is that it was done in the most wholesome of possible ways. I mean, clearly, you know, Roger Barker, this outsider professor from the University of Kansas coming to a small town where everybody knows everybody else, he's going to have to kind of explain what he's doing there and why he's interested in watching everything they do, including watching what their children do. I mean, he's very interested initially. He's one of the, I think he edited the first ever textbook on child psychology. So he's sort of an expert on child psychology, among other things. And he wants to, for instance, like observe their children in their home. So yeah, there's a sort of sales pitch that he has to make to the town for why he and his researchers should be able to do that.
He also, didn't he have to kind of make a sales pitch to the field of psychology and how it operated? I mean, if people didn't typically study their fellow humans in this way, it seems like he had to do more than just say, I need a small town.
Right. Well, he needed money. And luckily for him, in 1948, right around the time that he opens his field station, the National Institutes for Mental Health is founded by the federal government. And they're to fund, you know, psychological research. And they don't really know, I mean, you know, at this point, there are different kinds of psychology happening, and they're willing to fund innovative projects. And so Roger Barker, he writes great grant proposals, and he basically talks about how he's going to start a revolution in the field of psychology and, you know, tell us what, you know, basically get down on the ground with people in a small town. And, he's able to pitch it in a very convincing way. He's saying, you know, he pitches it in a kind of a Cold War setting. You know, this is a dangerous time for America. We need to understand more than ever how it is that people get along, how children get along with one another. He also, in talking up these studies to the townspeople, he talks about how great small towns have been for, you know, some of the great figures in American history. We've got, you know, President Eisenhower from Abilene, Kansas. We have President Truman from Independence. And kind of saying, look, small towns have always been part of what makes America great. We need to understand what it is about small towns that cultivate a certain kind of character and behavior in children that turn them into the kind of civic-minded adults that are the bedrock of American character and our democracy.
Did he find an answer to that question? Did he posit like a theory coming out of this observation of, yes, here is how small towns create great people?
You know, it takes a while. And one of the interesting things about Roger Barker is that he initially believed that it was enough simply to gather data. And this is very strange, too, in the field of psychology, that there wasn't really a theory behind it. The idea is like we're gonna function as a kind of psychological weather station in the same way that weather stations gather data on everything from temperature to barometric readings to wind speeds. People can do anything with that data later. They can forecast what the weather will be tomorrow. They can look at long-term climate trends. They can look at the relationship between growing seasons and certain kinds of climate patterns. And Roger Barker initially thought that what he was doing would be like the psychological equivalent of that. Let me just go out and just amass tons of data, put it in an archive somewhere, and later researchers can kind of figure out and parse the data and sort of figure out what it all means. So the short answer is that Roger Barker wound up collecting a lot of data. He does wind up coming up later in his career with sort of his biggest theory out of all this data. It takes a while, but finally, probably feeling some pressure to say something after collecting, you know, tens and thousands, actually hundreds of thousands of dollars in grant money.
And snooping on his neighbors.
Snooping on his neighbors, but he's very much accepted by the town. He and his wife are very much welcomed and are part of the town. Snooping on his neighbors, but they eventually came to accept him. I think one of the things that one of the mothers said to the Barker's team when they first started working there is, you'll be watching us, but we'll also be watching you. So he knows he's being watched, but he's a good faith actor and he's there to collect data. And one of the theories that he comes up with is, and I think this is still true of many small towns, is a theory of what he calls undermanning. Or in a more enlightened days, we might call it understaffing. And the idea is that in small towns, there are tons of jobs and roles for people to play, but not a whole lot of people. And so what small towns do is they ask more of their citizens that if you're on the town school board, you're probably also on like the sewer board and you volunteer, at the farmer's market and you are a teacher's aide in the schoolroom and, you coach the basketball team. And Roger Barker felt that there was something really valuable about that, that the ways in which small towns encouraged everybody, especially children, to feel useful and competent in ways that they wouldn't feel useful and competent in like a big city school where there are so many talented kids that only a small percentage are either good enough athletes to make the sports teams or good enough actors to make the school play. And Roger Barker felt that once these kids became adults, the world would separate them out into various, levels of talent and achievement. But when they were kids, every single kid, no matter their ability, needed to feel like they had something useful to contribute to the world. And Roger Barker felt that small towns excelled at doing just that.
What initially got you interested enough in Roger Barker, not just as a professional who changed the field he worked in, but as a person, like enough to research and write his life story?
I guess I've always been drawn to sort of oddballs and mavericks, people who are kind of working at the margins of their field, trying to sort of upend the field or identify blind spots. Sort of what is the one thing that our field just sort of takes for granted, maybe we're doing something wrong. The real inception of sort of how I heard about Roger Barker goes back to Labor Day of 1966 when my father picks up my mother in Washington Square Park. Now bear with me. My father is the son of he grew up in an isolated community, a small town, if you will. In the mountains of Kurdish Iraq. He's born to an illiterate mother in a mud brick shack, and he picks up my mother in Washington Square Park in New York City. And my mother is the daughter of a well-to-do Manhattan businessman. And so it's like he just picks her up in the park. And I became curious in sort of thinking about their love story, about the way in which the park itself, Washington Square Park in New York City, where my father picks up my mother, how that park itself kind of magnetizes these two very, very different people. And I wound up writing about their love story for an earlier book I wrote called Heart of the City. And that book was a collection of stories about couples who married after meeting by chance in one of New York City's iconic public spaces. So I tell these nine stories, but I also wanted to look at the ways in which psychology had addressed the question of how does place shape behavior? You know, do the buildings we inhabit, do the parks we walk through, do the cities we live in, do they in some ways, in subtle ways or even in not so subtle ways, affect the way that human beings behave? And as I started researching that question, a lot of the psychological science that looked at this, they sort of all would kind of pay tribute to Roger Barker as this kind of founder of environmental psychology. So in a weird kind of way, it all goes back to my curiosity about how my own parents, sort of the least likely of people, wind up, falling in love in Washington Square Park in New York City.
Big city. I mean, that is sort of interesting to me that your curiosity about how a big city shaped your parents' behavior led you to this guy who's studying how a small town in the middle of the 20th century was shaping other people's behavior.
Absolutely. And what's remarkable about the, where the overlap is when I asked my parents to retell the story before writing my earlier book, my mother pointed out that my dad had actually spotted her walking out like before she'd entered the park, but he didn't, and he thought she was cute, but he didn't have the courage to approach her. It was only once he was stalking her, but once he sort of followed her into the park that he felt like suddenly the park, like Washington Square Park, kind of shrunk the city. Like the skyscrapers vanished, and as my father put it, he was no longer in this kind of faceless, anonymous city. He was in a place that felt in a place where everybody who was inside the kind of park gates felt like family, and it sort of had a way of making the city small and village-like. And I think that's very telling. And I think that when my father saw my mom on the sidewalks of New York City, didn't feel like it was an appropriate place to talk to her. But once he's in this kind of cocoon of Washington Square Park, there's something that feels more comfortable, that he can approach a stranger there and it won't be taken the wrong way. And he winds up being right.
Well, in the case of Roger Barker and his research in the Midwest, you write really compellingly about a train ride that he takes before he's become kind of this maverick, maybe a train ride that even inspires him to start thinking in that direction. Can you recount that story for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. So, earlier in his career, before he came to Kansas, he was at the University of Illinois, and he would commute once a week to teach at a teacher's college that was, maybe a couple hours away from Urbana-Champaign. And it was a long train ride, and he would busy himself by looking out the window. So for long stretches of the train ride, he'd just be looking at soy and cornfields, not much to look at. But every now and then, there'd be this blur, of a small town, a crossroads, maybe one stoplight, and he'd look out and just wonder, like, what's happening in these places? Most of us, certainly if we don't live in small towns, that's how we experience the small towns in the middle of the country. I mean, they're written off in not so nice a way as sort of flyover country. But guess what? People grow up there. People live lives there. Even if they go to college, oftentimes they come back and continue to do whatever it is that their parents did. And this is more of a life, again, that we're describing that sort of pre-1950. But Roger Barker really becomes curious, I think partly because he also grew up in a small town himself in Iowa. Like, why don't we understand these towns better? Why don't we understand the ways in which the very physical environment of these small towns encourages certain kinds of healthy psychological outcomes and certain kinds of behavior? And those become, that kind of becomes a kind of turning point in his career, because before those train rides, he's kind of scattershot. He was studying everything from child psychology to rehabilitation psychology to how rats copulate. I mean, everything you can imagine. And it's only once he sort of has this quiet time on these train rides that he begins to question the very foundations of his field.
It's interesting to me that the outcome of the impact that he imagines small town life has on a person's psychology, that he starts with the premise that that is a positive outcome.
Yes, he does. And that may be perhaps his undoing in a way. Roger Barker, after coming up with these really interesting theories about how place shapes behavior, he wins hundreds of thousands of dollars of grants. He wins one of the highest awards given by the American Psychological Association for research. But he then kind of vanishes. I mean, his work is sort of, everyone kind of nods to it, calls it brilliant, says it was pioneering, it's never been done before. But the rub is that it's really never been done since. Psychologists have certainly come in and done what are known as community surveys, where they kind of parachute into a small town and kind of document the behavior patterns there. In fact, it's often, more often, sociologists that do that. Roger Barker didn't care what field people put him in. He said, I don't care. You can call me a psychologist. You can call me a sociologist. You can call me an anthropologist. I don't care. I'm a psychologist, and I'm going to do whatever I want within psychology. So he's kind of like this maverick, and he's not really paying a whole lot of attention about the connections that he's building with other fields or even with other researchers. And he becomes, in a way, I think, sadly and tragically, kind of captive of his own nostalgia for small towns and captive of Oskaloosa itself. I mean, there's something wonderful about embedding yourself in the town for 25 years. In fact, Roger Barker and his wife both end up dying of old age in Oskaloosa. They wind up spending 40 years there. But the consequence, I think, is that you can kind of lose sight of the way in which your research connects to larger themes that might be of interest to researchers beyond the small group of graduate students you have. And so, kind of sadly, I think his research has been forgotten, and it's been influential, but not in the ways that he expected.
When you went back and started looking at the kinds of things he documented and observed, did any of it surprise you, especially as someone who grew up, as we've established, in such a different environment? You grew up in New York City, it sounds like.
I was born in New York and grew up in LA. Yeah, so very, very different places. I mean, one of the most moving stories for me, and one that I still think was remarkable, was early on, Roger Barker was really interested in this kind of granular observation of behavior. And what he convinced a local mom to do was let six researchers basically follow their seven-year-old boy from the moment he got up in the morning until the minute he went to bed at night. So you can imagine.
They're hanging out in his bedroom when he wakes up?
In his bedroom, right. So your seven-year-old kid, second grader, you wake up and there's a researcher you've never met before standing over your bed with a clipboard and a timer. And I wind up tracking down this kid, and I write about him in a version of the book that appeared in Harper's Magazine a few years ago. But, you know, essentially what they're doing is a minute-by-minute record, a narrative record of this boy's life. I mean, everything from his putting his socks on to his, you know, feeding chocolates to his dog to his getting bathed by his mom. It's very, very intimate, and you know, every little moment of his day is recorded. And it winds up being published in 1951 as this book called One Boy's Day, and it's 435 pages of minute-by-minute description of one boy's day. And it's such a phenomenal read. I mean, even if you don't care anything about psychology, for me, and I guess maybe this was moving to me because I had a son about that age at the time I was writing the book, is the way in which you realize the millions of little moments that a child's day is made up of. And how, you know, the ways in which they move about their town, the experiences they have in their homes, the millions of little pieces that make up a child's day. And that I just thought was just a very moving thing to read. That's of all his research, that book just sticks with me in a way that, and haunts me in a way that nothing else that he's written has.
When you tracked that guy down, what did he have to say about that experience of being not just observed himself, but being part of a town that was viewed by this guy as a laboratory?
You know, I tracked that. He's called Raymond Birch in the book. He was a pseudonym, but after doing a little bit of investigative research, I was able to track him down to a small town in Pennsylvania. You know, and he didn't really have that many fond memories of the experience. I mean, I think for him, you know, to be, you know, suddenly exposed in such a way and not, you know, I think he was told about it briefly by his parents the night before, but I don't know how much of it really stuck. He didn't really have great memories of the experience. He also didn't have wonderful memories of Oskaloosa. He remembers being picked on by other students and teachers not really doing a whole lot to protect him. So again, I think there's a sense in which there was a nostalgia that infused some of Roger Barker's work that didn't apply to all of its citizens.
Well, our time is up, but Ariel Sabar, thank you so much for sharing the story of Roger Barker and his Midwestern outpost in Oskaloosa.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Roger, Ariel's book is called The Outsider, The Life and Times of Roger Barker. And you can listen back to this conversation or our discussion about office architecture at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. You can also keep in touch with us on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. Coming up, we're going to have Up to Date, but this show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, and Andrea Tudhope. We get help from our intern, Danielle Hogarty. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.